The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited. And Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. It also goes out to the Canterbury region on Plains Media, to the Wairarapa on Arrow FM, and we're delighted to welcome Waikato and Hamilton listeners on Free FM. So a big welcome to you people especially. Well, today I'm excited to bring you a third episode in our Front Footing the Future series, and today's guest is none other than Dr. Mike Joy, a well-known freshwater ecologist. But if you thought we were only going to be talking about freshwater ecology, think again, because you'll find in here everything from energy to student loans, from PV panels to dairy. So I do hope you enjoy it. I got a lot out of the discussion with Mike. Here we go. We've enjoyed the company of today's guests on several previous episodes of Climate Matters. Mike Joy is the Morgan Foundation Senior Research Fellow in Freshwater Ecology at Te Haerenga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington. Mike has never been afraid to speak truth to power, and in the freshwater field, that often entails giving big ag messages they'd rather not receive. However, Mike has a real ecologist's appreciation of the importance of wide boundary thinking, which leads him to engage far wider than rivers, streams, and lakes, and is a sought-after public speaker, such as at the coming Reality of Everything Symposium. Greetings, a warm welcome back, Mike. I'm greatly looking forward to our conversation.
Right, thanks, Lindsay. I really appreciate the opportunity. Cheers.
Even though you're a freshwater ecologist, I do want to kick off with wide boundary thinking. The concept, if you could elaborate on what it really means, maybe give us some examples, hopefully how it should guide our policy settings.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it's at the heart of an ecologist's understanding of the world is the boundaries are the edge of the known world. You take into account all of those connections, everything. The wide boundary view is the definition of an ecologist's understanding of the world. And in that way, you know, it's kind of probably possibly controversial, but it fits in so nicely with an indigenous view of the world as well. And, you know, understanding all those connections and things don't, you know, just how unreal and manufactured the idea of the economy is, you know, this tiny subset within this thing, but yet for most people that is the world, is this funny little thing called the economy.
Yeah, and I think your framing of it as the edge of the known world is such a good way of saying it. A, it's a long way out from where most people are thinking, but B, the known world leaves open the fact there's a whole lot of stuff beyond there that we haven't yet got our heads around, doesn't it? Are there any sort of examples that you can give either in your freshwater field or broader climate space where you think, hey, there's a case where wide boundary thinking either was applied or could have been applied better?
It's kind of a trap that humankind has got into with most of my work in freshwater has been around the impact of excess nutrients. So on the farm or at a farm or country scale, you can think of this nutrient that can boost production, you know, synthetic nitrogen. But at a wider boundary scale, you realize that what it is stored energy, you know, ancient stored solar energy that we're using to usurp and to overshoot natural processes of nitrogen fixation. Such a good example with dairy farming in New Zealand, where we used to fix nitrogen using clover in our paddocks. And then along came the deal with Shell BP Todd and then getting, locked into the take or pay scheme. And then when they discovered Taranaki Gas, the big oil companies did a deal with the New Zealand government where it was a take or pay scheme. So you're going to pay for it anyway. We want to make our profits, so we're going to give you this much gas every year. You have to come up with ways of using it. And so that was that mad rush, the think big. And part of that mad rush was to build the Kapuni urea plant. So suddenly you went from, natural nitrogen fixation to farmers then, getting this ancient, I call it eating the past. We're taking ancient, buried sunlight and turning it into food today, totally artificially lifting, production and population on the planet and all that kind of thing, where we now humans produce more nitrogen artificially than all the natural systems put together. So we've completely upset the nitrogen cycle, and then we pay the price, in polluted rivers, lakes, oceans, groundwater, human health's affected, just all of the downsides. But that the narrow boundary is like what it would have been the same with discovering the power of fossil fuels to power, everything that we use it for now. At a narrow boundary, it looks like the best thing ever. It makes our lives so easy. But if you widen the boundary, not just, spatially, but in time, and you realize that at that planetary scale, it's actually doing us an incredible amount of harm that's going to be virtually impossible to undo. We're a bit unusual in that, agricultural greenhouse gas emissions here are our biggest source of emissions, and yet it seems I get the feeling that nobody wants to talk about that at all. That just gets swept under the carpet. Again, it's this wide boundary view, but the simplicity of reducing intensity and reducing the number of cows as a way of reducing all of those emissions and harms. And yet that is the last thing that's considered. All of the, techno fixes and, stick them inside and capture the methane and, make methane genetically engineer, do all these things to try and kind of keep the system going without ever stepping back. Is it good for humankind at all to produce massive amounts of milk powder?
I don't know if you've come across Simon Miller, who's the executive director of Pure Advantage. And I've interviewed Simon for this series, although his interview will be on after this one we're just recording. And Simon was at the last Ag and Climate Conference, which I couldn't get along to. And I think his summary of it was business as usual, but with more tech
Yeah, that's
and
about it. Yeah.
just having fewer cows. In fact, we're
No.
going the wrong way.
It's the same with fewer cars or fewer anything. It just seems to be an anathema in a neoliberal kind of capitalist society that you never can talk about reducing anything.
Yes, because it seems to be contrary to the growth at all costs mantra, doesn't it, really? Just going back to wide boundaries a bit and perhaps trying to tie it into policy settings, I'm mindful that I think all of us who've been on the climate journey, we look at things and we think, oh, that looks like a good answer. Oh, electric vehicles or renewable energy or hydrogen for propulsion. And then when you look harder at it, you think, actually, hang on, there are some downsides here. And then after a while, you realize that you've got to move on beyond that. But most people, I think all of us, latch onto solutions, don't we, which seem to be the answer. And then wide boundary thinking means they're not the answer. I'm trying to lead you there. What should we do in a policy setting to try and ensure that we don't keep falling into those traps?
I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard in a policy space to kind of think about. It's so what the impetus seems to be is that you can't threaten our current levels of comfort. So you have to come up with ways to keep the system going, the system that we know. I talk about this as our crisis of imagination, that we can't imagine a world that isn't like this. So every time there's a threat to the world as it is, we have to think of ways we can maintain the world as it is, because that's all we know. So we immediately default to that. So all we know is cars everywhere and, everybody having their own car to drive around in. And so when a threat comes to that, or we realize the harm that it's doing, we just immediately switch to, well, how can we keep having those things? And of course, part of it is, too, is that is carbon or climate myopia. Electric vehicles are a really good kind of small example of that, where it's exhaust pipe myopia. You know, turn a blind eye to everything about that car, what it's made from, where it comes from, the roads that it drives on, everything about it, except for what's, you know, coming out of the exhaust pipe. And then there's all the inequality tied up in that, where, yeah, if you're wealthy, you can buy a nice electric car. And for a huge number of the poorer people, that's not an option.
Straits of Hormuz situation has started to open people's eyes to the enormous downstream range of products and things that come out of the fossil sector, hasn't it?
Yes. Although I don't know, Lindsay, the memes that come across my desk are solar panels don't get stuck in the Straits of Hormuz, and as if, you know, they grow on trees. And I 100% agree we have to get rid of fossil fuels. But when I say it in the understanding that everything I take for granted in my world will have to change if there aren't fossil fuels. But I think in most people's minds, oh, we'll do away with fossil fuels and life will carry on pretty much how it is, but we'll have all of these magic ways of making stuff. And that is just so incredibly naive. And so I suspect, you know, we're kind of doomed if policies are around trying to maintain. See, the thing that gets me is the thing that we're trying to maintain is the problem. Yeah. You know, everything's driving towards maximizing the thing that's actually destroying our future. You have a department of this and a department of that, as if these things live in isolation. And so all of the connections are lost. Again, it's just like the narrow boundary thing. We force these narrow boundaries by siloing things into small little parcels. Yeah.
It's an anathema to an ecologist like you.
Yeah, exactly.
Ecology is exactly about the relationships between
things. But you'll find many ecologists who just, you know, do exactly that. They'll know everything about the, you know, the sex life of a copepod, and you know, they'll do incredible work, you know, at this really, you know, reductionist scale. Not all ecologists get it, but, you know, the ones that do, and the ones, you know, I think of William Rees, you know, Bill Rees, and a few of these people who get it because they are ecologists and understand all of these connections. This is like two extremes. It feels like they're economists at one end, and the ecologists at the other end. And if you drew a Venn diagram, there's very little overlap between those two worlds, you know.
I'm going to put out there a policy setting that I once suggested to James Shaw, and his eyes lit up, and that was that the cost of getting a degree could actually be discounted over the years, just as you depreciate. If you buy a truck to deliver milk and you've done that in your past, you can depreciate your truck. And I don't think it's unreasonable for people to say, okay, well, I've spent $180,000 on getting my degree. I should be able to depreciate that over 5 years or 10 years or something.
Yeah, what a great idea. Yeah.
Maybe since we started with wide boundary, let's step our toes a little bit into even wider boundary. You mentioned the meta crisis before. We've heard the term the poly crisis, but I think for a lot of people, that's just eye-glazed territory. You know, they think, my God, the climate crisis is bad enough, and people are saying that's only a bit of the scene. Can you suggest how we frame the poly crisis or the meta crisis in a way that actually helps people grasp what's going on there?
You know, I'm struggling with this at the moment because I'm writing the paper that I'm giving a paper at the Reality of Everything conference on the poly crisis, meta crisis, you know, and so, yeah, how to frame it is really, really tricky. It's, you know, I think that best way for me to get it across is going to be going back to my Titanic example, electrifying the Titanic. And the Titanic is the meta crisis, and we're aboard this ship that's powering along towards an iceberg, and it's going to end badly. And, you know, a whole lot of people are down there in the engine room trying to convert that smoky, climate wrecking engine and turn it into a nice, clean electric one. And, you know, the band's playing on the deck, and people are rearranging the deck chairs and ignoring the fact that all you're going to do is speed it up towards hitting the iceberg. And so that
Yeah,
we've
that's
got
right.
to think about turning the ship around, and then you can start playing around with the engine and everything else. The main thing is to get on the helm and turn the bloody thing, or slow it down. It's excess energy that and from fossil fuels that's allowed us to do all of the harm that's created the meta crisis, all of these other, fished out oceans and, forests destroyed and biogeochemical cycles that are ruined, and all of these things are going to hit us. And so I try to use this other analogy of the four flat tires on the car. So if you think of, you go out to the car and it's got four flat tires, and one of those flat tires is climate change, and another one is, availability,
Biodiversity loss, or
biodiversity lost, and just, ruined soils so we can't grow food and all of that kind of thing, and polluted water so we can't drink it. And so we go out and the only one of those four tires we're working on is the climate change one. So we're going to fix that one. And so we've got four flat tires, and we've fixed one of them at the cost of the others. We're still not going anywhere. Either you fix everything, you either pump up, figure out how to fix all four tires, or you don't go anywhere.
I want to also move a bit into the freshwater space, because it would be nuts to have you on the program and not do that. We've had some bad news about freshwater recently with recent reports. We've also got, is it 20,000 more cows coming on the Canterbury Plains? Please put on your freshwater ecologist hat, and Mike, and tell us it's all going to be okay.
Well, I mean, it's just the classic is Canterbury is the freshwater disaster in New Zealand. It's ma you know, like 99, well, actually 95% of the problem is dairy farming, intensive dairy farming. We have incredibly high stocking rates. We have irrigation on a scale, more irrigation water consumed in Canterbury than all of the rest of New Zealand put together. You've
Is
got
that right?
individual farms that use more water than the city of Christchurch. It's just, and
Great.
it all happened since 1990. Little movie clip thing that showing the expansion of dairy in Canterbury. And when I grew up there was a dozen farms that supplied all of the dairy for the region. And then along came the 1990s and this massive expansion that just looks incredible when you see it, how fast it grew, which involved chopping down tens of thousands of trees that were shelter belts, or probably millions of trees in shelter belts, so you could put these big pivot irrigators. It involved helping yourself to water. Nobody kind of asked who does that water belong to, or do you have the right to take it? It was just a free for all. You have incredibly high levels of nitrate in drinking water now in Canterbury and further south. So, just the most classically obvious, scientifically provable freshwater disaster, and it's happened in the last 26, 30, 20, 30 years. And what do we do about it? We keep adding cows to it. Like, it is this complete and utter failure of policy and management. We have 800,000 New Zealanders. So I have to spread out a bit from Canterbury, but just of the 5 million New Zealanders, 800,000 of us get drinking water out of our taps that have nitrate levels, which mean an increased risk of colorectal cancer. We have the highest rates of colorectal cancer in the world. And if you look at where those cases are, they tie up with where the high nitrate levels. We have nitrogen levels in those Canterbury rivers that are higher than anywhere else in the world. It's very hard to see how policy makes a difference when you've got this case study of one region. I mean, there's some great stories to be told about them, sacking the council when they started trying to do something about it, and central
Yes,
government taking over
that
and
was
putting in those,
Ecan.
ECAN, and then sticking those, political appointees in there, and, an incredibly interesting but failed history of how to manage fresh water. And right to this day, with this coalition throwing out all of those freshwater protections, meaning more cows in a disaster. So it's just like having a climate disaster and then adding, more to it. If you look at the economics of it and the costs of the health, it is cheaper to pay those farmers not to have that intensity of cattle than it is to
Yes,
pay the health costs. And they've widened the boundary to, it's that same kind of thing where you're fed all of this information, you think this is how it is, you know, for the dairy farmer. Well, it's threatening and worrying for someone to come along and say this. The idea of the meta crisis and the fact that we have to reduce what we're doing is utterly threatening to everything that they've stood for it in their lives, you know. And so it's very hard to take and very hard to accept. I don't know how you ever put that in policy, but the reality that we have to reduce consumption, we either do it in a nice, sensible, managed way down, or we wait for the crash. But that when where we end up is not necessarily a bad thing, and if it's managed well, it can be a whole lot better than this kind of high stress, working your ass off to pay mortgage.
We started down this particular channel when I pointed towards freshwater ecology, but are there other aspects of your freshwater discipline that you think are worth highlighting?
The freshwater side of it is just a subset of the bigger problem that's happening in the world. And when you think about where rivers are and the rivers feed the lakes, and where we do on the land runs down, you know, everything flows downhill, so it goes down into the river. So we're seeing biodiversity loss levels much higher in freshwater than we are in terrestrial systems. So to me, rivers and freshwater are the harbinger of what we're doing, you know, all of these emerging contaminants all ending up in our freshwaters and groundwaters, and then and you know, coastal zones and dead zones that happen off big rivers. You know, it should be the red light on the dashboard. You know, it's the flashing light that we should be looking at, and we're not.
We could carry on for a long time, but yeah. I guess we have to stop at some stage.
Yep.
Are there any other climate policy issues that you're moved to comment on?
Well, it's just as an ecologist, I see that people are ignoring the impacts. I touched on it before. There is this kind of assumption that solar panels grow on trees, or that wind turbines are just, you know, just like electric vehicles, that people will just completely blank out everything that went into that because it's seen as a green solution. And I think my biggest worry in it is the distraction. So when I talk to, you know, people on the street, that their idea is that, yep, we've got a climate crisis, but we don't have to worry about it because renewable energy, endless headlines, you know, such and such a country ran on 100%, you know, renewable energy, completely missing the fact that it's not energy, it's 20% of our consumption, which is electricity. And they were 100% for, you know, a couple of hours in the middle of the day and when the wind was blowing.
We need a huge fossil fuel powered industry to get the technology to make the renewables.
Yeah. But people cling to it because it's what they want to hear. Delusion about renewable energy is just as dangerous as climate change denial, because the outcome is the same, that people ignore the fact that we have to change how we live and just carry on. We just replace one industry with another extractive industry, one that's even more extractive, and then we don't get anywhere. There is a bunch of research saying that actually action does come from people being frightened. You can't just frighten them. You have to guide people on what needs to change and all that kind of thing.
I guess you touched on it without using this word. One of the things that comes to my mind is we do need to give the truth, but we need to try and help people find some agency in it so that they have a sense. And maybe can I put out to listeners that you might be thinking that there's a couple of grumpy old dudes here saying everything's absolutely crap. I want to say that nobody would be more pleased than Mike or me to find that we're both wrong in all of this.
Yeah, completely. You know?
we're not moaning for the sake of being negative, but we do need that reality check, don't we? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I teach environmental science. I have to keep up with this stuff. I'd love to be able to not know it.
Have you got any final comments you'd like to make before we wrap up, Mike?
Just reminding people about the Reality of Everything conference, and that I'm just pulling together. I'll have it soon. We're completely sold out at the venue. But anyway, we're going to live stream. I'm in charge of that. So it's a bit of a worry, but I think I've got it sorted. So we're going to have a link so everyone will be able to join in for the morning session when all the talks are on. And I've already seen a couple of them and they're bloody good. It's going to be a good, there's going to be no waffling in these ones. You've got 10 to 12 minutes to to hammer it home, and we're really stressing honesty.
Terrific. Well, look, let's continue with a little bit more plug for that. So that's on the 26th of June. And although it's held in Wellington, don't try and get a seat because they've all gone. Okay. Well, look, Mike, on that note, thank you so much. I look forward to the Reality of Everything Symposium. Go well. And thanks always for you making time for this.
Yeah. Thank you too for your great work, Lindsay. Cheers.
Well, I take my hat off to Mike. I think he does an extraordinary job of pulling in salient facts and presenting them in a way that we can grasp. So a big thanks to him. Next week, we'll be listening to Professor Colin Butler, an Australian professor of epidemiology, of climate disaster, and climate disaster recovery, that is, and he's an expert in health and climate. And then following that, we should have Dr. Christina Hood, who's a very highly regarded climate policy specialist. And then after that, Nathan Surendran. Many of you will know of Nathan, who does outstanding work in the energy sector. Okay, I hope I enjoy your company for those episodes. And as always, kia kaha for the climate. As you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson-Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.